Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And James Kvasvik.
Hey, James. I know we're changing the format a little bit here, but change is good, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's how we progress. It's how we move forward.
That's right. And, it's one of these things that, you face organizations that are facing all kinds of changes. You implement new programs, you introduce them to new techniques or whatever. And I've certainly have done the same. And change at that level that's difficult, right? There's education that needs to be put in place. You have to have good leadership. You have all these good things in place. Yet I also find that there's plenty of old books, old theories, old material out there, old ways of doing things that are relatively valid and are still useful. And one of the resistances to change is that, the stuff that we've been doing is actually okay. Right? Have you seen that poll coming back?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. Change is probably one of the most hardest things to do in an organization. There's the push of, there's a variety of things. We've been doing it this way for so long. We've been successful this way. Why do we need to change? There's that piece. There's mm-hmm. just a whole lot of other pieces that, come as a result of that. Change is very difficult, but it can be overcome if you manage it correctly and go about it the right way.
Yeah. And before we dive into that, I want to also bring up that I received a message through LinkedIn this morning, and it was a follow on to a previous episode that we recorded on Speaking of Reliability with Philip Sage, and he had contacted me to talk about an article I wrote months and months ago on Drennick's theorem, which basically says that a very large complex system that will approach a constant failure rate over time as it gets mature. And as you essentially, in summary, it says that if you have a big system and you fix and repair things, that you don't replace all the motors all at once. As you replace one motor, then it's new and it's going to run to its length, and then others will fail and they'll leapfrog, and eventually it'll become a constant failure rate at the system level. And the gist of the article and the discussion with Philip is how that theorem is both true and misleading to maintenance programs. So the message I got this morning was, and it's related to this notion that they didn't want to change. And it was the gist of this message, or the question was, is that, so we have this complex system, and because of the Drennick's theorem, it implies that we just use a run to failure strategy for our maintenance, for everything. And,
that's probably not the best way to go about it. Can't just run everything to failure.
No, and that's why I wanted to bring it up with you, but it's also coupled with this change piece. And it's not so much, we want to use procedure B instead of procedure A. It's a difference in thinking about how you approach your maintenance programs and setting up. So before we dive into that, let's take a real short break, and then we'll get into some of the details of this change and making bad assumptions, I think.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Minitab Software for their support of Apex Ridge Reliability and the Ascendo community. If you'd like to learn more about their statistical software packages, please go to ascendoreliability.com/go/Minitab.
All right. So, James, I knew you were going to say run to failure strategy is probably not the right approach. Even for in a mature, complex system. And I have a couple of assumptions about what kinds of things you would object to in that realm. Now, let me guess. One of them would be some failures are just too expensive to let happen.
Absolutely. Maintenance is a business decision. It comes down to dollars and cents. That's what every organization looks at. Mm-hmm. So you have to evaluate what is the proper approach given the consequences of the failure. So if it costs more in terms of lost production, in terms of life, environmental damage, so on and so forth, then mm-hmm. then you should be doing maintenance. Now, if maintenance costs more than the operational losses, is it worth doing? Well, that really depends upon, are you maxed out in terms of production capacity? You know, how close is it? There's a lot of things that go into that. But essentially, if the cost of consequences is less than the cost of maintenance, why would you bother doing maintenance? That's when you run to failure. Mm-hmm. But if in most cases, it's not. Most cases, maintenance is a cheaper way to go. So that's why we want to do it.
Well, what you think of, I remember working in a big office in a, you know, we had hundreds of desks on this big floor, this big building, and they had all these lighting systems and different, they were experimenting with different lighting sources. Some were halogen, some were LED, some were fluorescent, the old fluorescent tubes. When they learned over time that if you get one fluorescent bank of light bulbs to fail, you just replace them all because they all tended to fail pretty quickly. And they were all, you know, if you got the ladder out and you got the box of tubes out, you do the maintenance and you just do the whole floor. And then you don't touch it again for years. Whereas some of the other ones, they didn't have that experience with it. So they would pull out the ladder and climb up there and replace a $2 LED light or a, probably $20 at the time, LED bulb. And it some of it's experience, some of it's what's the failure mechanism, and some of it what's the cost of getting a technician out there to actually have the equipment and do it.
Yeah.
It's a simple example.
Yeah, exactly. And in the instance where you're referring to for like fluorescent lighting, for example, yeah, they all pretty much have an end of life point where after so many hours of operating, you're going to get decreased lighting, then you're going to start to get failures and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So in that case.
Yeah. And they all are on exactly the same amount of time, you know, yeah, same environment, everything's the same.
Exactly. So in that instance, you know, it may make sense to do a full relamp mm-hmm. because we know approximate age, cost to get a guy out there to do one versus 10 of them, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's that balance we have to take when we look at what maintenance to do, when, how do we approach it? So in that instance, you know, it might be cheaper not to run everything to failure, but to run a few to failure and then just relamp at that point.
That's right.
But when you start talking about, you know, major complex systems, pumps, you know, boilers, stuff like that, running to failure is definitely not the right approach in most instances. It's not cost effective. A little bit of maintenance now, you know, is a lot cheaper than replacing a boiler in the future.
Right. That's right. And I remember working with a company that was had caustic soda going through some of their lines. And the criteria was that those lines, those pipes, had to be kept within a very narrow band of temperature to keep this material liquid. If it got too hot, it would solidify. If it got too cold, it would solidify. And then it took them weeks to cut out those pipes and re-plumb the thing and set up again. So it cost them millions if they got it wrong. And so they were the part of the design that we were involved with was within in a redundant heating system for those lines in order to guarantee that they would always be at a certain temperature. And the maintenance part was then the monitoring of those heating systems and making sure that they stayed in place in order to avoid this. If it went down, if that stuff froze, you lost production for weeks, plus had to redo a bunch of piping.
Absolutely. And in that case, maintenance is cheaper. The other thing you need to consider is, I say the six failure patterns that were brought to light by Nolan and Heap. Mm-hmm. When you look at end of life wear out, a lot of those end of life wear outs, it only counts for 11%. The rest of the stuff is either infant mortality or random failures that you can detect through
I appreciate what Nolan and Heap did, but I have a hard part with that, is that 11% is everything's going to wear out eventually if you don't replace it, right? And everything's going to fail eventually. Now, I agree that there are failures that occur early on, and some occur after mistakes in maintenance or damage to things or unique events like a forklift hitting your system. But remember, Nolan and Heap were looking at an aircraft maintenance for an airline system that was highly regulated, and they had to, I mean, they were replacing brake systems for aircraft well before they even had the chance to wear out, because the consequence of running off the end of the runway with an aircraft full of people was not worth the risk. So they would spend all this money and replace stuff that was perfectly good stuff. And so the only failures that were allowed to enter their system were ones that were early or middle of the life. So they artificially avoided seeing the end of life type failures, which if I was the airline, or especially as a passenger, I'm very happy to have happen. Kind of concerned about what those 11% end of life failures were. Maybe I really don't want to know.
Yeah. But regardless of that, I understand your perspective and I appreciate it. But regardless of that, though, if you look at it, though, run to failure, you know, letting stuff wear out over time, that's not the right approach, right? You can monitor certain things to see when is it starting to degrade, how quickly is it degrading. Then you make that conscious choice when it fails to meet your performance specifications,
right?
Or right before that point.
That's right. I've worked in so many factories where we're constantly monitoring product quality, right? So if my filler is losing its capacity to fill to a particular level, say some mechanism is wearing or a sensor is getting faulty, I can look at my product measurements to detect those kinds of things. In other places, you look at the equipment itself, the motor or whatever itself, but you got to look. And if run to failure means that your 2 weeks of production are all really bad, you probably don't want to do that. You know, I agree. We're already measuring a lot of the stuff that can give us clues as to how our equipment's running. And we just need to pay attention to it. It's frustrating to me. I'm sorry, James. It's frustrating to me is the number of plants I've been in that connections just isn't there. That mindset isn't there. Maintenance does maintenance, and product quality and product throughput is a completely separate entity. No, I think they're the one and the same.
Exactly. So we agree on that part.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at is run to failure is not the right approach because of the consequences of that failure, whether it's financial, loss of life, environmental contaminations. Running to failure is not an option in most circumstances. Mm-hmm. The other thing with run to failure that I think we need to consider is it a conscious choice or is that the default mode of maintenance?
Right.
If you use the RCM process, for example, you may decide that based on the failure mechanism, the consequences of the failure, and so on and so forth, that it makes sense to run to failure in this instance.
That's right.
To me, that is a conscious decision as opposed to the default, which most organizations that I've had the pleasure of working with default to is we'll fix it when it breaks.
That's right.
That was not a conscious decision based on probability, consequences, failure mechanisms, wear out patterns, anything like that. None of that was considered. That's just how they did it.
Yeah. And that's the frustrating part. It seems to be the default. And then this message I got this morning was looking for a theoretical justification for that.
There is no theoretical justification for defaulting to run to failure. It needs to be decided upon by the cross-functional group of people based on the risk to the organization, the cost of maintenance, cost of consequences, all those different things.
Well, you haven't mentioned the now I'm drawing a blank. It's the criticality matrix, if I remember right, that you've talked about in a number of episodes.
The asset criticality?
Asset criticality. I think that plays a role here too, doesn't it?
To a point, I think. When I do an asset criticality, you may take that top percent, top whatever, 5, 10%, and you do a full-blown RCM analysis on those. The bottom 5%, you just do the bare minimum compliance requirements or warranty requirements, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Now, does that apply that that lowest group would also be run to failure because they're not that critical to the system, or is that decision still need to be deliberate?
It still needs to be deliberate. So in those bottom, that bottom part of the criticality assessment, those assets there, I still advocate that any compliance requirements are addressed, any warranty requirements are addressed. And then at that point, anything over and above is decided upon based upon the history, whether it's, it could even be a conversation in the group. It doesn't have to be a formal RCM analysis, but the team has to say, yes, this does fail. When it does fail, it costs us this. This is what we found worked in the past. They have to have that conscious conversation. If they just, oh, it's the bottom 5%, we don't worry about it. I don't agree with that because of the compliance or warranty or other things that may come up and cause consequences to your organization.
Well, it's, you know, it's still things that can fail that can damage your product output. It can reduce your throughput. It can take resources away when you don't really have them to spare at that moment. The overall consequence doesn't mean you're going to shut the plant down for a month, yet it still has a hit impact. And it's, I think, understanding what the cost of maintenance and just that balance, that quick decision saying, no, this makes sense to prevent. So when we're out here doing have this panel open anyway, let's replace this piece. That might be the cost-effective way of solving that problem. If we only have it open every 6 months, let's just replace it. It's not worth waiting for it to fail.
Exactly. That, you know, you pay your maintenance craftsmen so many dollars an hour. They, if they go check something once a week for an hour, then, you know, say that's $40, give or take. You know, over the course of a month, that's $160. If that fails once and it costs you 1 hour to repair, and that's it, there's no lost operational, there's no lost product, no poor quality product, anything like that comes up. Does it really make sense to spend that 160 to save the 40? No.
No.
Very simple example, but it's those types of questions that you have to ask yourself. Is it really worth it?
That's right. That's right. You know, and you can leverage some of the compliance stuff. I know working with escalators in my background is that they had to basically do a bunch of safety checks on a regular basis, and then involving opening it up panels and making measurements and checking things. But while they were there, they're doing lubrication, they're doing adjustments, they're doing all of the compliance type stuff, but then they did the preventative maintenance. And when they would spot something through the inspection, then it would go into the system and get worked on. Usually their next visit there when they open it all up again. It wasn't like they lost production. It's an escalator. Yet it sure hit customer satisfaction in the facilities. In the, as a transit system. So in a factory, the cost of downtime is very obvious in vast majority of plants I've worked at. And there, it's an easier decision to make. Whereas these guys with the escalators were struggling with, well, how do I quantify customer satisfaction? And so I showed them a picture of a mom with a baby in her arm and a toddler looking at the flight of stairs next to the escalator. So there's the value.
Yep, exactly. But it's that, it's once again, that's an operational piece, right? If that's part of a transit system, that's what your customers expect. That's part of your operational deliverable. So you should be able to quantify that one way or another.
That's right. Yeah, and we actually figured out a creative way to do it, but that's probably a subject for another whole story. So part of what I wanted to connect this back to change is, as we kind of wrap this one up a little bit, is I did an article on this theorem, and I saw how it's been misused to justify this assumption of constant failure rate. Now, in an RCM program, if the system I'm dealing with really does exhibit a random failure rate, I have a random voltage spike, you know, once a quarter or something, and it damages my system and I have to repair it, there's nothing I can do to monitor or measure that coming in. It might be cost prohibitive to put in the power protection systems and everything else. And we just deal with it. And our history says it's random. But that's a particular failure mechanism. And so when I got this message this morning and saying, well, we have this big, complex, lots of redundancy, it's just a big, complex system, that means I can use this assumption, right? All right. Just no, as you said, no, not really. No, I think maintenance is on the failures mechanisms. Does this wear? Does it corrode? Does it go out of alignment? Does it need lubrication? Does that break down? Plus the lightning strikes and forklift crashes and everything else. You got to do maintenance on the failure mechanisms of your system. And as you point out so well, James, is that it's a conscious decision. What's the cost-effective approach? What's the right way to do that?
Exactly. And it does require some analysis, you know, like we talked about before. It may even require talking to your friendly accounting friend to help work some of this out.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And, you know, they love getting their hands dirty, no pun intended, with, you know, stuff that helps people make real decisions rather than a bunch of MBAs. I've read it. And I laugh because I remember, you know, tracking down these financial analysts, essentially, they were called in the organization, and saying, hey, you know, I'm trying to sort out how much does it really cost when we have this kind of repair versus this kind of repair? And their eyes light up. Oh, I heard about that in school. We can do activity-based costing, and we can do this, and we can do that. We got this data. And just took off with it. Had a great time. Got great data, great information from it. But you got to ask. You got to go track it down.
Oh, absolutely. But they are definitely a resource to help with some of this stuff. And there are formulas that are available to help you sort this out. I can't remember if it's in the CRE body of knowledge or if I saw it somewhere else, but there's actually ways to look at the risk, the cost, all kinds of things, and decide what is the right approach. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then also not only the right approach, if you have to do maintenance, what is the right frequency?
Right.
To do that. So there's a lot of things to help you optimize that. So if you do have to do maintenance, what is the optimum inspection rate based on the cost, based on the consequences of failure, so on and so forth. There's lots of different tools out there to help people not only decide, is it more cost effective to do maintenance or not? But if we do have to do it, how do we optimize it based on risk, cost, so on and so forth?
That's right. Yeah. Good point. And yes, change is hard, but changing the mindset to challenge those assumptions and to think through how you're making decisions, I think, is the answer to this question we got. No, this theorem doesn't justify you doing run to failure. You got to think this through a little bit. And back to the person that wrote this in and others listening, you know, if you've got this kind of question, make sure you listen to Rooted in Reliability. James talks to me on occasion and a good number of other people in the field, plus provides really practical information about doing and improving the maintenance programs in your organization. So a little plug there, James, for your show.
Well, I appreciate it. Every week, every Tuesday, new topic, some new guests, some old guests, but we definitely try to provide tangible takeaway information that our listeners can use every single day.
That's perfect. Appreciate that. And as listeners, you know, if you've got similar kinds of questions, this question I got this morning turned right into an episode. So feel free to head to reliability.fm and you'll find Speaking of Reliability, Rooted in Reliability, and a number of other shows in the reliability.fm podcast network. And you'll find suggestion boxes and comment fields. You can reach out to us through LinkedIn or through email. We love hearing from you. And it's good to know there's somebody on the other end of the microphone. It gets lonely listening. Here talking it's good to know there's people listening. So we love hearing about that. And more specifically, the format of the show is that we want you at the table. We want you to join the discussion. And so by providing topics or ideas or suggestions or stories, that just makes the show that much better. So we look forward to that. So once again, James, thanks for joining me on the show, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
All right. Thanks, Fred. Take her easy.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.